Well, it's good to see everybody this evening. Welcome to our Bible study. We're happy to be together and looking forward to finishing up this quarter, studying the years of silence. Now, at the end of this quarter, we've looked at captivity, return, and years of silence. So I've got about half a lesson left over from the class period, last class period. I'm going to try to cover that and then do a quick review of the whole quarter. Next quarter starts Sunday. We'll be beginning the life of Christ. So read Luke 1. For Sunday morning for that class. Wayne will be teaching here Sunday morning, and then I'll try to take most of the rest of the quarter. There is a schedule for the next quarter, a syllabus, if you will, on the pew in the foyer, both ends of that, if you want to pick up one of those to keep up with the readings in Scripture and from the Waldron material, so that's there as well. But tonight, we're going to stay busy, so buckle your seatbelt. Okay, gird up the loins of your mind, as they say in Scripture. We're looking at these three time periods, captivity, return, and years of silence. And we're toward the end of the study of the years of silence, as I said, and we're talking tonight, to begin with, about the development of the Jewish sects, the denominations, if you will, within Judaism that existed in the time of Christ. Well, how did they develop? Where did they come from? We've already gone over some history that clues us in as to where they came from and how they developed, and hopefully we'll be able to bring that together in discussing what these sects were and how they impacted the New Testament. So let's just start with a review of a few things that we've probably mentioned already going through. Hellenism was spread by Alexander the Great and his successors. Hellenism simply means to Grecianize, to make somebody Greek in culture. So it was Alexander the Great's intention in conquering the world not to necessarily put his thumb on everybody with the iron fist of Rome that came later, but to persuade people to become Greek, compel them if necessary. But essentially, Alexander purposely, and his generals that followed him, purposely tried to spread Greek culture everywhere they went, to Grecianize people. Of course, Jews encountered those Hellenistic influence in Palestine throughout the Greco-Roman world and throughout the Greco-Roman world. So many Jews outside of Jerusalem in places like Alexandria, Egypt, were very willing to adopt a Greek lifestyle and blend it in with Judaism. Now, it wasn't so much accepted, say, in Jerusalem around the temple, although somewhat, as we'll see, but especially in the outlying areas, in places where Greek cities had developed to centers of culture and learning like Alexandria and other places, the Jewish communities in those cities were very willing to latch on to Greek language and culture. And for that reason, by the way, the Old Testament scriptures were translated into Greek in the intertestamental period, largely probably by Jewish Greek scholars in Alexandria. So we have the Septuagint as a result of that influence. Other Jews, though, particularly in Judea and Jerusalem, resisted being Hellenized because they saw it as an attack on their religion, but also on their culture. These people were known as the Hasidim, which translates as the pious ones. The Pharisees and the Essenes in the New Testament are going to derive out of the Hasidim. The Hasidim came to be in the Maccabean period. During the time of the Maccabees, the lines were drawn between the Hellenists, those who were willing to adopt the Greek culture. You remember, again, going through what Antiochus Epiphanes did, there were Jews in Jerusalem that were willing to compromise with him and with the Greeks that followed. And those would be the Hellenists, and then there were ones that stood firm against that, both religiously and politically. Those would be the Hasidim. So that was kind of set in the time of the Maccabees and then developed even further as history went on. So what are the ramifications of all of that? Due to the religious purity that they were insisting on, the Hasidim are going to be less willing to cooperate with Greek and Roman political authorities, which means that they're not going to be in power politically. They're going to have a lot of sway religiously, but not as much as the Hellenists would, because the Hellenists were willing to compromise with the Greek and especially the Roman authorities. So what it winds up being is that the high priesthood and a lot of the Sanhedrin winds up being the Hellenists, later the Sadducees, as the grandchildren, if you will, of the Hellenists. So that comes to bear in the New Testament. As we begin then to talk about these sects, we'll talk first about the Pharisees and the Sadducees that we already know some about, but in light of this history, I think we'll learn a little bit more and understand a little bit more about the background and the impact it had in the New Testament. So the word Pharisee means separated ones. Again, they're the descendants of the Hasidim, and that's a word that means the pious ones. A lot of Jews, you would think, became Pharisees. Seems like in the pages of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, there's a Pharisee on every other page, right? They just seem like they're all over the place. But really, the number of Pharisees was relatively small. It was a very exclusive, extremely pious group of men. There were about 6,000 of them at the time of Herod the Great, according to historical sources. They believed in angels and spirits and an afterlife. So in all of that, they had the correct understanding of the spiritual world, much more than the Sadducees did. They accepted all of what we know as the Old Testament. They would have all of those books as part of their canon or Old Testament Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures that we have in our Old Testaments. But they put a lot of emphasis on oral laws and traditions, especially the oral laws that have been passed down by the rabbis to this point. Not much had been written down yet as far as the oral traditions goes, but a lot had been passed down, and they were keeping to those pretty strictly by the time Jesus comes into the world. They kept the Sabbath strictly, of course, but they added a lot of traditions connected to the Sabbath and other things as laws, and we see that in the New Testament. They will treat their traditions equal to or even superior to the Old Testament laws. Jesus chastises them for this multiple times, that they held to the traditions of men rather than to what the law said, rather than what God said. They also devised a lot of legal loopholes to God's laws and to their own traditions, and Jesus points some of these out. You know, can you swear by the temple, or is it okay to swear by the gold of the temple? And one was, you know, a binding oath, and another one was not. They had all this trickery that they put into all of that, so that they wind up being extraordinary hypocrites, despite their claim to be pious. And before I get to this last paragraph, let's just say this. Do we have those problems today sometimes? You know, the besetting temptation of those who are striving to be holy and pious is hypocrisy. And we need to see that as a real problem for those of us who are striving to adhere to the law. And then we come up with our convictions about how we personally should adhere to the law. But then when we start to bind those convictions on other people that are our personal convictions, and we try to make that law for everybody, and we pass that down from generation to generation, then we become truly what the Pharisees were. And that's ever a temptation for people who are striving to do the right things. So we need to recognize that. That's kind of a no-joke kind of a thing. Sometimes we say, well, Pharisees today, but there's an issue there. But the Pharisees really created a lot of the religious culture that we see in the first century. They didn't invent the synagogue. I think the synagogue was kind of invented during the times of captivity, when Jews were worshiping in lands, even when they got left in the captivity lands after the return. We see like Esther and people like that. There were assemblies of Jews in foreign lands and then coming back when the remnant returned. But they fostered the synagogue sort of as an institution of religious worship outside and separate from the temple in Jerusalem. So the synagogue is considered a Pharisaic institution, not strictly true, but it's considered that since the Pharisees developed it, raised it, to high eminence and gave it the central place in Jewish religious life. There's nothing wrong with the synagogue. In fact, there are Old Testament scriptures that authorize Jews to assemble for religious purposes outside of Jerusalem, specifically talked about that. So that was okay. Jesus put his stamp of approval on the synagogue by being part of synagogue worship on numerous occasions, as well as did the Apostle Paul. But that was sort of a product of something the Pharisees did in line with Old Testament teaching. The Sadducees, obviously a much different group. The name Sadducee is derived from the sons of Zadok, who's a priest in David's time. They're a smaller group even than the Pharisees, but they wielded, as I've already indicated, a lot more political power because, number one, they controlled the high priesthood, and they were willing to adopt the culture of their Greco-Roman overlords. So they made friends, went along with the Romans and earlier even the Greeks. Their beliefs are laid out for us in Scripture. Essentially, they believe that only the Torah, the books of Moses, were authoritative. That's an interesting tidbit. So they didn't really accept the prophets, the books of history, the books of poetry, as authoritative. They read them, but they didn't accept them as law at all. Just good stuff to read, just good stuff to know. They didn't even know most of it. When Jesus, you might remember, has discussions with them, he does not quote typically the prophets or the Psalms to the Sadducees. You might remember when he's arguing with them, or they're arguing with him, about the resurrection. Remember the woman who had married the seven brothers and each one died, and then in the resurrection, which one of the brothers will, you know, be her husband? Jesus answers that by going to what passage? Is that burning bush passage, right? In Exodus, yeah. Exodus 3. He doesn't there's lots of places in the Old Testament where you can go to read verses about afterlife. Job talks about living again after life, and David mentions it obviously in the Psalms two or three times at least in pretty plain language, but he doesn't go there with the Sadducees. He goes back to Exodus because they were supposed to believe Exodus. They said they didn't believe the rest of it, but they were supposed to believe Exodus, so that would be a powerful passage for them. So all of that comes to bear in what we see in the New Testament. So they denied the existence of angels, spirits, and an afterlife, and Jesus dealt with that in Mark 12 and other places in that last week of his life as they came and tested him. You might remember in Acts chapter 23 and verse 6, Acts 23, Paul is arrested. He's before the council. There was a high priest by the name of Ananias that commanded him to be struck on the face. And there's interchange between Paul and the high priest. But it says in Acts 23 and verse 6, Paul perceived that one part of the council, the Sanhedrin, one part were Sadducees, the other part Pharisees. He cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope of the resurrection of the dead, I'm being judged." So Paul throws out, really what I'm being judged here for is because I believe in the resurrection. Now what's that going to do in the council? All of a sudden there's a big argument because the Sadducees aren't going to put up with that. And the Pharisees are going to say, well, you're hurting our guy that believes our doctrine here. So he's got them arguing with each other in the middle of that council. But that again, comes to bear several times in the New Testament. The Sadducees' religion was really bound up in the temple, which they controlled because of the high priesthood. They craved political power as well. So the Sadducees are elitists. They're aristocratic. They are religiously liberal. They are the country club set of the first century. That's really what they are. They would engage in Greek cultural behaviors almost to the same degree that some of the pagan Greeks would, as we'll look at, I think, maybe before we get done. So Jesus is a threat when he comes. He's a threat both to the Pharisees' religious hold and to the Sadducees' political hold. So he becomes enemies of an enemy of both groups. And they're willing to put aside their differences and coalesce on, let's get Christ crucified. And that's exactly what happens, as there are both Pharisees and Sadducees that are on the council when they decide to take him to Pilate. The high priesthood comes down in pretty clear history from the time of the Maccabees to the time of Jesus. We have records of the name of every high priest from the time of the Maccabees to the time of the destruction of the temple. Immediately after the Maccabees gained control of the temple again, Jonathan Apphis, who's one of the brothers, becomes high priest. Then Simon, his brother, becomes high priest. Then John Hyrcanus the first, son of Simeon Tassi. Then Aristobulus the first, son of John Hyrcanus. Alexander Janneus, son of John Hyrcanus. John Hyrcanus the second, son of Alexander Janneus. You get it, there's a dynasty, right? So these are all sons of, or nephews of, or whatever, on the priestly lineage coming down from the Maccabean family, the Hasmonean dynasty. You might remember that the Maccabees were both priests and warriors, and they brought together the political, military, and religious rule of Israel from 160-ish BC down to the time the Romans came, over 100 years later. So Israel was independent of any overlords, any invasive powers during that time. But that's how the priesthood flows down to the time of 37 AD when the Romans take over. Okay, here's independent, the Hasmonean dynasty, there's independent Judaism. But under Roman rule, the high priest serves at the pleasure of either the ruling Herod or the Roman governor. The line of succession continues from pretty much from the priests that were the Maccabees, from the Hasmonean dynasty. But which one of the guys who is of that lineage gets to be priest is up to the Romans or the Herods a couple of times. So you have that them listed here starting in 37 BC. And some of this, we talked about the intrigue of some of this happening when the Romans took over. You come down to 6 to 15 AD, Annas ben Seth, and that's Annas of the Gospels. And he is the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who is the high priest who has taken over. The reason Annas had been high priest and probably still would have been when Jesus was on trial, but he was set down by the Romans because he'd had somebody put to death. And so the Romans took away his priesthood and gave it to the next guy up. And so he was, but to the Jews, he was the godfather of the priesthood, if you will. He was the guy. He was still looked that way when Jesus was on trial. That's why Jesus was taken to him first before he was taken to Caiaphas. You might remember that little bit of detail in John. Anyway, here's Joseph ben Caiaphas or Caiaphas. And there are others that come into the biblical story, particularly down here. There's an Ananias I just read about in Acts 23. This is probably that Ananias right here in 63 AD that Paul confronted when he was standing before the council. He is not. Josephus claimed to be a priest, but he was not of this line. This is a good question. Just real quick, this is the Caiaphas ossuary and some coins. An ossuary is a bone box that a skeleton is put in after the bones dry out in a tomb. And so you can save space in the family tomb by putting all the skeletons in one big box. That's an ossuary. And this particular ossuary had on the side of it the name of Caiaphas written out. And it was discovered in the 1990s, not all that long ago. They were redoing a road outside Jerusalem. But anyway, most scholars believe this is genuinely the ossuary of the family of Caiaphas. There's some doubt about that, but it seems very likely. These coins were found in the mouth of a woman who was buried in that ossuary, along with the bones of a man who would have been about the age of Caiaphas. But the coins are in the mouth of the skull of that woman, because what she need coins in her mouth for? She needs to pay the boatman when she crosses the river Styx, right? You guys know the story? What mythology is that? Greek. That tells you how far the Sadducees had gotten into Greek culture. That goes right in line with what we know about them. They're just, as I say, just liberal as a goose. You know, that's how loose they are. And that's an indication of it. That's an interesting archaeological find. Let's talk a little bit about the Essenes. The Essenes are not mentioned in Scripture, although they may be related somewhat to the life of John the Baptist. Some people have speculated about that. There are things about them we don't really know. But I bring them up because they do seem to be an important sect relating to keeping the Jews pure and keeping the law in their day and time, but also keeping the Scriptures, I think. Let me explain that. As I say on the screen, little is known about them, but it appears that there was a community of Essenes, most scholars at least believe that's the case, outside of Jerusalem, down in the Judean desert toward the Dead Sea, that there was a community there at Qumran. And from what we can tell, the Essenes lived in secluded communities. They were not quite monastic because they would have families living together in these communities. They were very restrained. They were very sober. They rejected oaths. They were super hyper religious kind of people. Many of their doctrines seem to be very similar to the Pharisees, but they are not mentioned in the gospel. Philo and Josephus both indicate that there were about 4,000 of them in the first century. So there is this, what seems to be an Essene settlement there at Qumran, and went the wrong way. There's a baptistry, what's called a ritual bath here, and a kiln for burning pottery there. This is very close to the Qumran caves where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. In fact, you can pretty much see the caves from where that settlement is. So the assumption is the Qumran community, the Essenes, made the scrolls, hid them in those caves when the Romans came, perhaps. That's some of the thinking about that. But anyway, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls probably because of the Essenes. So that's some background. A little bit about the Zealots. The Zealots, doctrinally, were a lot like the Pharisees and the Essenes. They objected to being ruled by Gentiles, so they wanted to overthrow the Romans in the time of Christ. This began about 6 AD. Judas the Galilean and Zadok the Pharisee rebelled against Rome. They refused to pay taxes to Rome, and they regarded loyalty to Caesar as a sin. In the New Testament, Simon is called the Zealot or Canaanite. That's a little bit deceptive. It's not a Canaanite as a dweller of the land of Canaan. It's a different word. It's an Aramaic word that means zealot, okay? It's a word that literally means zealot. So it's not that he was a citizen or a descendant of the literal Canaanites of the ancient land, but that he's a zealot. It's a different language there. In any case, Simon the Zealot, if he's the wanting to overthrow Rome, how would he feel about Matthew, the tax collector who's collecting money from Rome? Yeah, they would literally have been mortal enemies. Simon, when he was a zealot, may have assassinated somebody like Matthew. That's how serious it was. So, and yet, they're both called to be disciples. The Herodians come into the New Testament story multiple times. They are basically Jews who are allied with the Herods. They believe that the salvation of the Jews was through the Herods, who, as we've said, were converted from Edomites, converted to Judaism. So they thought, well, these people are really Jewish kings, so if they could be our kings, we'll be okay. And they gave their loyalty to the Herods as a result of that. They were a minor party, but very supportive of the Herods. So those are the sects that we see mainly the end of the period of the years of silence. What I want to do now for the next few minutes is give us a really quick review, a bare bones review of the whole quarter. Anybody have any questions about what we've just covered or something you want me to clarify, if I can, before we get into that? All right. You have the same look my 11th graders do every day in class. It's like, just clear as mud, Mr. Klein, clear as mud. The captivity, the return, and the years of silence. So the captivity is the 12th period of Bible history, as we identify them, like the Waldrons do. It goes from 606 to 536 BC, generally. 606, 605, the first captives are taken by the Babylonians. Nebuchadnezzar is king of Babylon, Daniel and his three friends. And, of course, they remain pure in the midst of trial. And they come out of the trial purer than they went into it. And that's what God intends for all of his people during the captivity. He was purifying them by that. And really, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are symbols of what God's intending to do with his people. In 597, the second group of captives is taken. Ezekiel is among them. They're out by the river Kibar, and he sees visions, first of the imminent destruction of Judah and Jerusalem, the final captivity, punishment, but also he sees visions of ultimate glory, what lies beyond that for the people of God. 586, Jeremiah, who's been prophesying in Jerusalem and Judah the whole time, witnesses the fall of Jerusalem, and Judah is carried away captive. So the major prophets of that time period are Daniel. We remember him with a lot of D words as he, through God's power, interprets the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar, refuses the delicacies and the dainties. We remember Darius throwing him in the den of lions. That's a span of 70 years that takes place from the first thing happening to the last thing happening. So Daniel's in captivity that whole 70-year period. He was taken captive in 606, and he lived to see the Persians come to power and his people let go in 536. Then you have Ezekiel. He's a priest and a scribe. He is among the exiles. He's among the everyday people. He's explaining to them why what is happening to them is happening to them. He says that Egypt will fall. He says that Edom will be desolate. He says that God's people will be restored. He was taken captive, as I said, in 597 BC. And then you have Jeremiah, who also is a priest and a prophet. He works in Judah and Jerusalem. His message is that justice is coming, and justice isn't going to be very good initially for the people of God. They're going to be punished severely. He begins to prophesy at least 626 BC, possibly even a little earlier, and prophesies through the destruction of Jerusalem and really a little bit beyond then, because he's carried off into Egypt by some of the remaining captives. So at least those 40 years and more. We looked at this map a good bit, and I think it gives us a connection between the names and the places of this time period of the captivity and then the beginning of the return. You start down in Jerusalem with Jeremiah prophesying in the reign of Josiah. You go then 606 to Daniel, taken to Babylon, and then 597 Ezekiel, taken to Babylon. So these three major prophets that we just looked at, that's where they are as they're making their prophecies. Later on, Esther and Nehemiah are remaining in the lands of captivities after the captives go back home. and they have experiences. Nehemiah himself will eventually go back home and rebuild the walls. This is sometime after the period of captivity. You have Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah coming back to Jerusalem, all for different purposes. Zerubbabel rebuilds the temple. Ezra restores spirituality to the people. Nehemiah, political stability, and rebuilds the walls, so military security as well. So God is taking care of his people, doing exactly what he wants done in this time period through these great individuals and in these places. All of that just by way of review, and we've seen all of that this quarter. You have Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi as prophets that rise up to spur the people on to do the things that they need to do. Haggai and Zechariah to build the temple, and Malachi to get back and be faithful to God as they look toward the time of silence. All right, so return from captivity, as we go through it kind of blow by blow. 536 is the first return, the decree of Cyrus, king of Persia. That starts in Ezra 1 and verse 1. Again, Zerubbabel comes to build the temple. It's not like Solomon's temple, but it's going to be greater because the Messiah is going to bring his glory to it, and greater things will happen as a consequence of it. Zerubbabel builds that temple in 483 BC. Esther becomes queen of Persia, queen of Ahasuerus, and God preserves his people even in the lands of captivity. He's with them and helping them be what he wants them to be, even in far distant lands. In 458, Ezra comes back. He restores the worship, the spirituality of the people. And then in 445 to 443, Nehemiah comes back and rebuilds the walls. Amazing feat of leadership and God's providence. Nehemiah leading the people to rebuild the walls in 52 days. Malachi ends this period with the promise at the end of his book that God's going to send Elijah the prophet before the coming of the day of the Lord. So, again, just real quick right there, right? Bare bones as you can get bare bones, but hopefully all of that is bringing to mind things that you have learned this quarter. These are important dates that we've looked at. I showed this chart a number of times, especially early on in our quarter. But it gives you, of course, dates are not necessary to memorize, but it does help you follow the flow of time and events. If you kind of know the dates and what happened, and we're really blessed with the luxury of knowing the dates. There's not much doubt at all about any of these dates because of what's going on in secular history and how well that was dated by, say, the Babylonians or the Persians in their records. So we have a really good concept of exactly when most of this happened. 612, Babylon defeats Assyria. Assyria had taken the northern kingdom captive 100 years before that and mixed them up. Now Babylon defeats Assyria and becomes the power in the Middle East. We've talked about already the time of captivity from 606 to 536 and what happened there. The Medes and the Persians defeat the Babylonians, the handwriting on the wall, 539. And then the first return under Zerubbabel, ordered by Cyrus, king of Persia. You have the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah in 520. The temple's completed finally in 516. The story of Esther's in a gap here, and then a second return in 458, and Nehemiah with the third return. Lastly, the prophecy of Malachi about 430, maybe a little bit later than that. And that's where we enter into the years of silence. So that we just covered. I don't owe you quite as much review on that because we just finished that 10 minutes ago. But we'll go quickly and just say, here's what is in the years of silence. You have the prophecies of Daniel 2, Daniel 7 and 8, and Daniel 10 through 12 foretell many events that take place during the years of silence. The Babylonian Empire, the rise of the Medes and the Persians. You remember that image with the two arms? The Medes and the Persians, the silver. Then you have the bronze that represents Greece, and the iron mixed with miry clay, which represents Rome. So that succession of kingdoms, and especially the rise of Greece and the four subsequent kingdoms that come after that, really breaks out what happens during the intertestamental years of silence. There's this troublesome conflict between the Greek kingdoms of the north and the south, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies that we've talked about for several weeks and shown how that impacted God's people who are caught right in the middle of all of that, impacted them greatly and shook out with the things we just talked about with the various Jewish sects, the political situation, the rise of the Herods. All of that was a consequence of what went on with those kingdoms. God's people are caught in the middle. And Antiochus defiles the temple, causes the daily sacrifices to cease. God's people finally get it back and take the temple over and rededicate it, establish a feast that we know today as Hanukkah, which is the feast of dedication. The rededication of the temple is what it celebrates. It is celebrated in the New Testament in John chapter 10. So again, that's further history that flows from this time period. But through a lot of conflict, God's people throw off oppression, but then Rome rises to dominate the entire Mediterranean basin, and that has much to do with events that occur in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and really all of the New Testament. The Roman domination, by the way, if you think about it, from a historical and cultural standpoint, and the problems that Christians face even after the church was established, Roman domination overarches, from that standpoint, everything that goes on in the New Testament. I mean, it begins with the reign of Caesar Augustus, the New Testament does, and it ends with the destruction of Rome, right? In the book of Revelation. Not completely at the end, but that's much of what Revelation's about. Christ wins the victory over the evil Roman Empire. So that really overarches a lot that happens in the New Testament. Questions or thoughts before we stop? All right, I remind you, you have a syllabus on the back pew if you'd like to get one. Read Luke 1 for Sunday morning and have sweet dreams about all this.